There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 236. And with me today, I have two of my traveling buddies. You guys have heard them before. Steve Applin, who blogs at Canadian Energy Issues and is a professional energy analyst, and is often featured on Canadian television, and apparently was not watching March Madness this week. He's too into hockey to bother with American basketball. And also we have Meredith Angwin, who is a blogger at Yes Vermont Yankee, and is continuing that effort even though the Vermont Yankee power plant has been formally shut down and its fuel is removed and it's into the process of being decommissioned. But they're still... Vermont is still having an impact on the nuclear view around the country, and maybe she's going to find her. So, actually, you've also added another blog. You're doing
Northwest Clean Energy blog for Energy Northwest.
Ah, Northwest Clean Energy. So another local blog.
Yeah, it's another locally focused blog. I am supposedly lead blogger, but actually I don't think I blog more than one half the time or maybe a third of the time. There are other bloggers too, but it's all about energy in the Northwest, which I think is just tremendous to have a local blog like that becomes a resource for everyone.
Well, that's important because
there's so much going on up there.
I was going to say there's a lot going on in the Northwest. I know there was a recent initiative to both add support for small modular reactors, and I think there was a poll taken of the feelings about nuclear energy in general in the Northwest.
Yes, there was a poll, and the poll showed that 63% of people support it, and something like 53% think we definitely should be building new reactors.
Wow.
And it's really was quite interesting. And Energy Northwest has a agreement with NuScale that would get SMRs built. I'm not sure exactly where the money comes from. I think some of it comes from the Department of Energy. Some of it, I didn't track that. I just think it's neat that Energy Northwest is interested in that, and that the bills going through Washington State Legislature include tax breaks for building SMRs in Washington State. And as I wrote in one of the blog posts that I did write, Washington State is a great place to build SMRs because you already have all the knowledge of building big, complex, safety very important pieces of equipment known as airplanes.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, of course, there's also a pretty large established nuclear presence out in the state of Washington on the east side of the mountains.
Yes, there's that. That makes it, that is what obviously you think of, like, oh yes, they'll do SMRs there. It's part of their whole nuclear energy development history there, and their interest in clean air energy out there. So, you know, nuclear development, clean air, yeah, absolutely. But when you think about it, there are not many places in the world like Boeing.
Oh, absolutely. That manufacture large, complex, safety, important, multi-hundred-million-dollar machines, and they do it at a rate of several a month.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think that is, it'll be a tremendous place for the development of SMRs.
Yeah, there's also some, that's where TerraPower is headquartered as well, in the Seattle area, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I'm sorry to say I don't have it in front of me, but there was a list in at the end of the blog post of the different places and where they were headquartered, and I don't have it in my mind.
Do you have the URL at your fingertips, or I'll make sure I put it on the show notes, but if you don't worry about it. I'll give it to people in the show notes, and we can just click on it.
Okay. I'm sorry.
But if you feel like it at the end of the show.
I don't know. I'll open it up right now, and I'll tell you in a minute. Why don't you ask Steve a question for a minute?
Yeah, let me clarify. You said Northwest Energy, right?
Yes. The other side of the country from where she is.
Not Northeast. Okay.
No. This is
the Northeast hates nuclear power.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Because that's what I was thinking when he said 63%. I said, what happened to these people? Anyway, okay. Not a laughing matter, but I know what you mean.
Actually, I think it's probably the support in New England is probably a lot stronger than most people realize. It's just that they've been intimidated at public meetings and don't speak up. Yeah. Although, I guess there was a public meeting held in somewhere near Pilgrim, right, Meredith?
Yes, it was the Pilgrim. Yes, indeed. I'm sorry. I'm trying to do two things at once, so I'm not doing either of them well. Yes, I'm.
I'll ask Steve a question. Never mind. Go ahead. You finished up.
Okay. Northwestcleanenergy.wordpress.com.
Okay. Northwestcleanenergy.wordpress.com. Okay. And then now we'll go on and say that there was a good public meeting in New England.
Yes. Pilgrim meeting.
Yeah. We've talked about the out of control meeting at Vermont Yankee, the last one there, but the Pilgrim meeting apparently went very well.
Yes, it did. One of the reasons was that there were more than more supporters there than opponents, and that's a major reason. Though a friend of mine who goes to both the meetings said that the opponents in the Plymouth area are much more polite in general than that is in the Massachusetts area are much more polite in general than the ones in Vermont. I don't know why.
Wonder why that is.
Well, I don't know why that is either. I will say that the one time I was watching that, it was when Howard Schaefer was actually debating Arne Gundersen in Plymouth. And the debate had been set up by a local group that has both people that work at the plant and people who are opposed to the plant. It's a kind of like a town committee. And I think that the existence of that town committee for many years has led to more civility, because people are going to show up and they're going to be on the committee with people that disagree with them, and they're going to have to deal with it in a way that isn't always just playing to the cameras.
Was it an NRC meeting?
Yes, it was an NRC meeting.
Yeah, I think the meeting that Pilgrim had was the NRC holds annual meetings to report on their inspection of the plant, I believe.
Yes, that's right. And some of those I have, the ones about Vermont Yankee, I have written about them, and they have included really completely outrageous behavior. At one point, the NRC people were escorted out of the room by the police for their own safety because the meeting was getting so out of hand. And then in another case, there was a manure thrown. I mean, they are not, to say they're they're not Robert's Rules of Order, is putting it mildly. They're quite intimidating. But apparently the Pilgrim meetings have not been that way.
You know, it's interesting. I also, in my news feed this morning, there was a little note popped up from a New Jersey newspaper. And the New Jersey, this was one of those news summaries that you get from local papers, and it had a bunch of different things. And one line in there was that they had a public meeting about the three plants on Artificial Island. And I think those are the Salem plants, plus I can't remember what the other... There's three plants all on one island, and there's two different names. But anyway, they had the public meeting, the annual NRC meeting, and the paper was disappointed because nobody showed up. The only people there were the NRC and the people from the representatives from the plant, and they had nobody to talk to.
That's kind of funny.
Even though the meeting was announced, it was kind of interesting. So you have extremes of emotion, a civility, and no interest at all.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one thing that's happening a lot, or happening at this time in the U.S., is that we're going through the budget process. I lived for 9 years in a budget cycle, so I have a pretty good feel for what happens when you get the presidential budget submission to the Congress sometime in late January, early February, and then the Congress holds hearings to talk to the federal agencies that have asked for money, and they get to ask questions about priorities and those kinds of things. And sometimes the budget hearings have been rather interesting to watch. This last week, I've watched the Senate Appropriations Committee for Energy and Water, the Subcommittee for Energy and Water, apparently has budgetary authority now over both the NRC and the DOE from the Senate side. So I watched Senator Lamar Alexander, who's the chairman of that subcommittee, talk to both the chairman of the NRC, actually talked to the entire commission. All four commissioners were there. And then later on, about a week later, he talked to Secretary Moniz from the Department of Energy. There were some interesting things that came out of those hearings that one thing about the NRC's budget is that it is going down. The NRC has decided that they were way too aggressive about the supposed nuclear renaissance. They hired too many people, and now nobody wants to put in applications. So they decided they don't need all those people anymore.
That will lead to a lag if anything picks up.
Well, see, one of the challenges I have with the whole method that the NRC is funded by is that people who want to have the NRC review their applications have to get billed at the time they ask for the services, the regulatory services. And I almost put those in air quotes, by the way. But when you want the NRC to do something, you have to pay them $279 an hour to review. That's per bureaucrat hour. But the NRC, and the NRC is supposed to collect 90% of its budget from fees. Now, it gets probably two-thirds of its fees from the operating reactors and their annual license fee, and about one-third come from the applicants. However, even though people have to pay right away, the NRC doesn't get the money. The money goes into the Treasury. The NRC has to go through an annual budget appropriations and ask for money based on what their future workload is. And the way the budget cycle works is they're really asking for, when they go through their budget process, they're doing the analysis sometime in 2014 for what they're going to spend in 2016. And so there's a big lag between a demand signal and money coming in. There's also a big lag between the demand signal going away and money disappearing.
Exactly.
So when the money goes away, when the demand goes away and they've done the hiring based on the anticipated demand, now they have extra people sitting around. And it was interesting to see what on the House side, Representative Simpson had a beautiful little exchange with the NRC, who, and he said, you know, he says, I've been in government at all levels, local, state, federal, he said, and whenever you've got government people who've got time on their hands, they think of something to do. Yeah. And he said, when it's regulators, that's really dangerous because they start writing new rules, whether they need them or not.
It I guess it's not leading to a to quick, you know, normal reviews. Now that they've got extra hands helping them.
Yeah, I think sometimes the more people involved, the more time it takes. Although
the more time it takes,
it is important to make sure. And the hearing kept talking about being right sized, and Representative Simpson on the House side, when he was kept hearing the word right sized, he said, "Yeah, that sounds great, and it, you know, we all want to be the right size and have the right people at the right time." He said, "But you're not doing a very good job of it right now."
Well, I one thing, I haven't really kept up with all that well, but is when a Vermont Yankee was getting its license application reviewed by the NRC, the process took many years. It basically took many years because people kept making contentions and so forth. You know, opponents did. I wrote a blog post quite a few years ago showing that a sister plant of Vermont Yankee had a license that was reviewed in 2 years because I think it's Duane Arnold, because there weren't a lot of people trying to shut the plant down with contentions every other day. But what I'm saying is, does the NRC people have enough with these, quote, extra people? Could the NRC make some of these license reviews go faster, or were they going as slow as ever?
Well, you would think. One of the things is that the NRC aligned a lot of its budget over the last 4 years to respond to the perceived lessons learned from Fukushima. So you had a lot of people working on those. And there was also a couple of challenges to the waste confidence rule that had to be reworked. And that actually put a moratorium on license renewals as well as new licensing for 2 years. So although there was a period where the NRC had more people there to review license applications than what they thought they really needed per application, because there weren't as many applications, they found plenty of other things to do, so they actually didn't get ahead. There was a recent press release from Westinghouse where they announced that they had received a safety evaluation review, SER, safety evaluation report, sorry. And that announcement got people excited, thought Westinghouse was maybe getting back into the small modular reactor game. But what it turned out was the SER was on a very small portion, very small topical report that talked about their the PERT table that they have to submit for all of the things they want to test on their small break LOCA. So it's not really a big topical report, but somehow it took the NRC 3 years to review it.
And this was recently.
Well, the press release was issued recently because they finally got the SER. They'd actually turned in the report in 2012. So,
but there had been there in anticipation, like you were saying earlier, of the Renaissance. It's not like the NRC was understaffed, and that's the reason.
No, it's just priorities, I think. And priorities was a big topic in the Department of Energy's budget review that would occur just this last week, I think on Wednesday. And Senator Alexander, I'm a big fan of Senator Alexander. He asked Dr. Moniz straight out whether he would rather have $6 billion per year to spend on a mature or subsidizing mature technology like large wind turbines, which we've been supplying the tax credit for those for about 23 years now, or $6 billion a year to do energy research and development. And Secretary Moniz was unable to answer that question. He said, "Sir, I'll have to think about it. The administration supports the tax credit."
I didn't think it was
that hard a question myself.
No, it's a pretty obvious question. He's been pretty vocal about wind subsidies in the last little while. Alexander has.
Yeah, in another part of the hearing, he asked about a particular transmission line project that is going from Oklahoma to Tennessee. He said somebody wants to try to sell the Tennessee Valley Authority wind power via this transmission line that has to go through Arkansas. And he said, and the people in Arkansas aren't terribly happy about it. And he said, and why would the Tennessee Valley Authority need to buy wind from Oklahoma when 50% of its generation is nuclear and 20% of its generation is hydro? You know, what would wind do to help the Tennessee Valley Authority clean up its emissions? And I thought of you, Steve.
Yeah, that's because that's the situation here. We've got most of our power is nuclear and hydro, and what is wind doing other than making it more expensive and less reliable? Not less reliable, but just causing, you know, adding to the cost of stabilizing and making us dump power into Quebec.
Right. The power that you get through your power socket at your house is going to be reliable.
That's right.
But the amount of effort and cost that goes into the people at the distribution centers and the transmission control centers is far greater than it should be.
It's far greater than it should be, and the whole game is worth the candle thing. No, this is just it's political correctness. Nobody notices that the plug level, as you're saying, because it's all backstopped by something. It's all backstopped by the true sources. This is just window dressing, and it's complicating things and making things more expensive, and adding a very small amount to the grid. 4% in 2014 was wind in Ontario.
There's a similar situation in the Northwest because you've got the traditional.
Excuse me, I'm going to break for a minute. I hear something, almost a little beat going on. Anybody else hear that?
I don't hear any beep.
I don't either.
Just then? Okay. Go ahead, Aunt Meredith. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that the situation there is the same as in the northwest of the United States. You know, we have those beautiful big dams that were built and huge amounts of hydropower out there, from the 40s, 30s and 40s on. And then there's a nuclear plant, and there's a coal plant, but the coal plant is scheduled for shutdown anyway. And then they build all this wind, and it just makes running the hydro more complicated. I have some write-ups about that in the Northwest blog. Basically, if you have to back up the wind with hydro, then you managing the hydro in a certain way, and it isn't you're supposed to manage it for demand, and you're supposed to manage it for the fish and for flood control sometimes and for recreation, and then you've got and for wind and pretty soon it becomes a very difficult thing to do,
and all of those different interests have a different way they want the lake levels to be maintained.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's all for zero carbon power, which hydro was already providing.
Yes, exactly.
At a low cost, at a cost that was born years ago. It doesn't make sense. This is how important public perception is, because the public likes this. The public, anybody who knows anything about it doesn't, but the public does. The public loves the idea of wind turbines and clean energy.
Well, they love wind turbines if they don't live underneath them.
If they, that's what I should say. People in downtown, you know, I'm from Ontario. People in downtown Toronto love wind turbines. There's one wind turbine in Toronto. It's this showpiece that's right next to the CN, or just west of the CN Tower. It's 750 kilowatts, and whoop-de-doo, that's the only one. And downtown Toronto loves wind. Downtown Toronto doesn't live on wind. It lives on nuclear. But the public likes it, and the public votes in the government that says it's going to build more of them, and by God, that's what it's doing. So it's important what the public thinks, and the public has been schooled to think the wrong way, in my opinion.
Yeah. Now, there was a pretty good documentary about Ontario wind, and I can't remember the title. I've actually got it in my library.
Yeah, Big Wind.
Yeah. And they made it pretty clear that there are people that own large amounts of land who are very happy to get rent from the wind turbines, but other people who are not big landholders and have, you know, turbines close to them are not happy about the varying shadows that they get depending on the angle of the sun. They're not happy about the noises that they get, and they're not happy about the effect that the turbines have on their livestock. I guess the low hum tends to cause their dairy cows to produce less milk.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the issue of the creatures that like to fly in the places where there's lots of wind, the soaring birds and bats that are affected. You know, one of the challenges people have, they say, well, why can't they just avoid it? Those turbine blades don't seem to be moving very fast. But they don't understand how fast the tip of that wind turbine is actually moving to make it all the way around in the time it makes.
That's right. And these creatures are not used to something spinning like that. It's a foreign motion to them, and it's easier said than done to just dodge it and fly between it. That's you're taking your life into your hands if you do something like that. It's a problem. It's really too bad that this has taken flight. And like I said, all this aggro for what? For 4% of our 4% of our electricity and 14% of the cost increase.
Well, on a happy note, I was pleased to see that some people from Texas, the practical people that they are, recognize that they have a large amount of rather unused land, and they already are licensed to handle low-level nuclear waste, so they've decided that they're going to put in an application to set aside enough of their land to house up to 40,000 metric tons of used nuclear fuel.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's incredible to hear something like this. It's.
Well, it's actually not so incredible when people who are practical minded hear, people continue to say, well, there's $30 billion or $36 billion in the spent the nuclear waste fund. And the government's not spending it. They're not able to take fuel away from people that really need it to be gone. And they keep describing this as a problem. And, you know, people that understand how things work in the world say, well, wait a minute, it's not that big a problem. We've got 1,000 acres over here that's not being used. We'll build a few parking lots, and we'll accept people's shipments, and we'll also take some of that money.
That's the practical side of it. We've got a whole process in Canada looking for a resting spot for the Ontario fleet's waste or used fuel, and there's a lot of practicality on that level. I just wish there would be more unanimity in the among the people who are choosing these things, because you could make a lot of money.
Well, there's never going to be unanimity. Even in Texas, there's going to be people that say, hey, we don't want that on our roads or for whatever reason. But, you know, we live in a democracy. You can never make people, everybody happy. Democracies don't require unanimity, do they?
No, that's true. They don't.
We don't.
It's okay. What I wish, let me rephrase that. What I wish I would hear is, just more voices in favor of the thing. Like, it's really tough for me to get a sense of what the community mood is for something like this. I get the impression that it's pretty much across the board against. But the mayors who advocate these things have all been reelected, so maybe that's a good sign.
Is that in Canada they've been reelected, or the people?
Well, in the most recent provincial municipal elections, which were just last year, the mayors who in the communities that are in a certain part of the process to select a host community, the mayors that indicated at least going forward with the process and you know determining whether it's a suitable place, they were all reelected. So it's as opposed to mayors who are just outright against it. I'm not sure about. I think that the mayors in all the communities that advocated at least going to the next step of the process. It doesn't mean we're going to get the repository, but to the next step, everybody who advocated that was reelected, as far as I know.
Well, you know, one of the things that has always amazed me. Is that in the U.S. there are many, many communities, rural communities particularly, that will fight tooth and nail to be selected as the site for a new prison because it brings in jobs and revenue.
Yeah.
And I've always told people tried to tell people living in places like that, that used nuclear fuel is far better behaved than any group of convicts. And less likely to escape from its containers.
Yeah, and choosing a career where you're managing this stuff is nowhere near as stressful and destructive on your psyche as it is working in a prison.
Absolutely. And I have a personal experience with that. Somebody very close to me actually had about 10 years worth of difficulty after spending just 6 months working as a prison guard.
I know a fellow as well. A friend of mine has done that, and he's never recovered from it. He's retired, early retirement, and he's never recovered from that job. It's an extremely stressful job. Yeah, you'd be much better off choosing a nuclear used fuel repository.
You know who would do best?
You don't have to go to prison guard jobs. I mean, I remember when I was back in Palo Alto, and I told people that I would be happy for my kids to work at a nuclear power plant, especially if they had a choice between that and the chemical plant. They should definitely choose the nuclear plant.
Because absolutely.
The chemical companies have always fought even revealing all the chemicals that people are exposed to. I mean, it's better now, and there's more rules, and OSHA is better, but, you know, chemical plants have... You know, there's not been healthy places to work.
Yeah.
And nuclear plants have been. And people just looked at me like, oh, boy, she must not like her kids. And I'm like, no, I'm a chemist. I have a fairly good idea. I mean, you just really can't be a chemist if you walk into a lab and you think, oh, my God, everything in here is equally hazardous. You can't do anything. You just stand there.
Yeah.
So you get to be a kind of a judge of, like, you know, is this something that I have to handle carefully, that I don't have to handle carefully, that absolutely have to pull the hood down whenever it's even sitting around, that, you know, I can work with the hood up and be pouring. I mean, I'm sorry, it's just one of those things. And if you think, oh, well, that's the arcane chemistry stuff. Well, to some extent, you learn that when you're working in the kitchen. I mean, boiling water is dangerous.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's some things in the kitchen that can be kind of hazardous, at least if you get them in your eyes or under your skin, and of course knives are not exactly the safest things in the world, so one has to learn to make good judgments about your environment, and to be able to prioritize risks. That's one of the reasons I get so adamant and so angry with people who can't see how low hazard low levels of radiation are. Even if you accept the linear no threshold model, which I think is exaggerates the risk at low levels, a linear model still says that at low doses, there's low risk. And at very low doses, there's very low risk.
I thought of something recently, you know, when there was this horrible gas explosion in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about various things. One thing is that you might say that an explosion of any kind or a fire of any kind, there's one way that it could kill you is by the direct heat of the fire. And that's similar to in a nuclear accident, only in Chernobyl were people killed by the direct radiation. Okay, but that's equivalent. Let's look now at the fact that that fire makes a lot of soot, okay? And, you know, areas are blanketed with smoke and so forth. Do we ever see any pundit go on the radio and say, due to the fire, which was, of course, in the heart of a major city here, we can expect X cases of lung cancer in 20 years?
No, you never see that. But it's a totally valid point.
You know, you hear that equivalent statement for nuclear all the time, you know.
Yeah.
Well, nobody died in the accident, but that's because they haven't died yet because there's going to be excess cancers. Well, you can go through a calculation and find out that there are going to be zero to very few excess cancers, but somebody is sure to say, well, even one is too many or something like this, even though you can't actually tell if there's one, and they say, ah, that. But what I'm trying to say is, here comes the smoke.
Yes.
There's a fire. Someone was killed, and there's all this smoke because the gas main exploded.
Well, you know, some people have a difficult time understanding my humor. And when they'll say, you know, well, there were people that got cancer from radiation after the bombs exploded at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I say, you know, there are still survivors of those bombs. And they're living long lives. And by the way, every once in a while, some of those survivors get cancer. Is that surprising that somebody who was alive in 1945 gets cancer?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you know what caused it? You know, and oh, by the way, the most recent analysis of the results are that cancers are occurring at a lower than expected rate for the survivors these days. So, but okay, I'm going to go on to something else. We haven't talked much. I think it's been a while since I've talked to people on the Atomic Show, and there was a senator from South Australia who has determined that one way to jumpstart the economy in South Australia is to start becoming a destination for used nuclear fuel from all over the world. But he doesn't want to just have the fuel come and have it be stored there. He wants to build up an inventory and then start recycling that fuel into more fuel.
Which is a excellent idea, and I love hearing that, because what that does is it puts the threat of competition into some of these hesitant host communities that I was just talking about earlier. You know, the money's not going to go to all of them. It's not going to go to a whole bunch of communities, even on this continent. It's going to go to just a few of them, and they could be one, or it could be this place in Australia, and you can forget about that money.
So that becomes a forcing function. I once went through a period where I was not completely as employed as I wanted to be. So I started to go to a few of these classes that would teach you how to be a salesman, which was not really my cup of tea. But I remember clearly them talking about forcing functions to try to get to close on a sale. And
is that what it's called? A forcing function.
A forcing function. You know, you got to get the deal closed. So you have to, you know, motivate the person you're negotiating with to make a decision quick. You know how it is when you go to a used car dealer and they'll say, "Well, I got a special deal for you today, but it's not available tomorrow."
Yeah, or you know, maybe this is more something for your next door neighbor. Maybe they're more. wait.
Yeah. So, Steve, what's going on in Canada these days? Anybody put in an application for a small modular reactor or anything anytime recently?
I was just at the nuclear conference, the Canadian Nuclear Association annual conference, and somebody asked the head of the regulatory commission about this. And he said, we hear all about this, but boy, we would love to get an actual application on one of these things, because all we hear about is we just hear about it. We don't get these applications. So he said, we're ready. We're ready to review these things. Just somebody bring us your application. There's all these great ideas: oil sands, remote northern communities, mines. There's all these applications that people put out there, but so far nobody's come to them. I'm a guilty party in that. I kept on talking about nuclear process heat over the years, and I even went to the regulator with a reactor design in mind, and then never pursued it because I didn't have the funds to do that. But that's where it's sitting. As far as small modular reactors are concerned, we've got medium-sized modular reactors that are creating the electricity that I'm using to talk to you guys right now. But nothing new on the horizon, unfortunately. There's a company that's selling a molten salt reactor that's going around talking about the concept, and it'll be interesting to see what their next step is.
Well, interesting enough, when you hear regulators, at least from the U.S., and I think it's probably the same in Canada, when you hear them say, "We really want somebody to come in with an application," I'm kind of skeptical. I actually hear them in the U.S. saying, "We really want to have somebody we can be billing."
It costs $2 million in Canada to do a vendor pre-project design review. That's what stopped me from talking to them, was that I couldn't get my client to fork over the $2 million because we didn't even have a design in mind. But yes, it's a source of revenue for the regulator, and that's right. So if it weren't that so expensive, if priorities changed and it was recognized across the board that we've got to, let's look at climate change, that we need to put some sort of reliable technology in place to curb greenhouse gases, perhaps this kind of upfront payment that you would need to even get the regulator to talk about your machine or about your design wouldn't be so onerous. But $2 million, $2 million is $2 million.
Yeah, the cost of those reviews is pretty high, particularly when they're open-ended and you have no way to control them. That was always the hurdle when I gave presentations for Adams Atomic Engines, when people said, this is a great concept, you've got a good plan, you've got understanding of how you're going to make these and where you would make them. He says, "How are you going to get permission, and how much is it going to cost?" And that was when I lost every potential investor I ever had. So
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. Well, that's, this is the $2 million is for the regulator to say, "Yeah, we don't see any inherent obstacles. We don't see any, inherent design features that's going to prevent this thing from being regulated." Now, now you start the real thing. So it could go for quite some time before you get a sort of a lukewarm. It's not even an endorsement. It's just we don't see any barriers. That's what you're paying $2 million to hear ultimately, and you might not hear that. So it depends on, there are light water regulators, there are heavy water regulators. I don't know if there are any molten salt regulators out there, but they all need to you know, they all need to learn this technology, and boy, you're paying them $2 million so they can read up on this stuff. So it's so.
Understand. So that's good. Hey, Steve, what did you think of the World Wildlife Federation's global, what do they call that, Earth Hour?
Earth Hour, yeah. Every year I do something about Earth Hour. I've always felt that it was a very, it reflects just a terrible state of uninformed opinion. Yeah. when it comes to energy and the environment. You know, turn off your electric powered lights and light a candle, which is 9.99 times out of 10 made out of paraffin, which is a petroleum product, and an inefficient, dangerous one at that. And I just think that, well, what are you asking people to do? What are you asking them to return to an earlier era when we didn't have electric light? It's anti-electricity, and it's asking people to do things that they're not going to do.
Well, I was very amused because I happened to be on Twitter last night during Earth Hour, and I was amazed by how many people were posting tweets with selfies that showed what they were doing on during Earth Hour. Think about that for a minute.
I know.
You have to turn off your lights, but you don't have to turn off your computer.
Exactly. The internet doesn't run on, it's not a perpetual motion machine. There's some generator spinning out there, and something's making that generator turn.
Exactly. And those servers that you're using to communicate with large numbers of people around the world are large databases and big iron. There's, in most of them, there's just lots and lots of little iron that consume a lot of power. But I was just amused. It was funny to see how many people
That didn't come down for a second. That, you know, the World Wide Web, which is powered with electricity, you know, the servers all over the place, it didn't come down for a second, and they're backed up and backed up and backed up to make sure that doesn't happen. So, yeah.
We're having a very, very cold spring here, and it was cold last night, and you can bet that our thermostat and our furnace were going. I mean, we don't keep the house hot, but I wasn't about to turn everything off for Earth Hour, and I don't think anybody does. I mean, they may be turning off a light. Oh, I'm turning off a light, and I'm using a candle here. But the electric pump for, if you're living out in a rural area, the electric pump for your well, I don't think you're turning it off.
Not turning that off, exactly. There are people who drive to my favorite one is people driving downtown and walking around and going into candle-lit restaurants. It's not energy, you know, it's not saving energy. It's turning off electricity. Your car is not powered with a magical, you know, thing that transports you without any cause and effect. I shake my head when I hear this kind of stuff. Thankfully, I was with a bunch of people who all ignored it. And then after it was over, I said, you know, Earth Hour just finished. And everybody said, oh, yeah, it was Earth Hour. And then the conversation continued. I didn't even have to interject with my angry, you know, anti-Earth Hour stuff.
So. Well, it's all a matter of who you hang out with, Steve. If you hang out with the right people, they all understand that electricity is a good thing. But even in groups of people where their job is to make and sell electricity, I get really strange looks when I ask people, when was the last time you asked your customers to use more of your product?
When was
the last time you told them how good your product is, how beneficial it is for them to use it freely so that your sales could actually increase and you could justify investments in newer and better equipment? You know, why is it that the electric power industry doesn't understand that all products, even the best products, need to be marketed? Yeah. You know, I've been watching the basketball tournament, and I can't tell you how many times I've seen advertisements for some really good products, some fantastic cars, some terrific mobile phones, a brand new watch that's really looking cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen advertisements, television advertisements for watches, anything like I have in the last few days, because Apple's coming up with their new watch. Yeah. But, you know, why is it that people have forgotten that there was a time, and I know this personally because I knew a lady who this was her job for her first 25 years of her career. There was a time when electric power companies would hire home economics majors who could explain to people how to use electric appliances.
Yeah.
And there was a guy named Ronald Reagan who filled his house full of electrical equipment and made commercials for General Electric.
Yeah.
To encourage people to use more electricity so they could build better plants. Anyway,
yeah, it's amazing. We used to, our provincial utility used to be called Ontario Hydro. They used to have a slogan called "Living Better Electrically," where they did exactly that. They told you, listen, you can improve your life using electricity this way, this way, this way, this way, this way, with this thing, this thing, this thing, blah, blah, blah. That was canceled, and it's when you bring it up, if you bring it up to an old Ontario politician, they'll laugh and just say that was the dumbest thing we've ever done. Because that was in the days before conservation. And that's the prevailing wisdom. It drives me around the twist thinking about this kind of stuff. It's so stupid. Go ahead.
No, I think one thing I wish everybody would do if they could, but of course it's hard to get a hold of it. But the BBC did a series of taking modern people and having them live in old times. Okay, and one of them was something called 1900 House. And what they did is they took a building in the outskirts of London that had been built around 1900, and they tried to return it to the way it was in 1900, which it didn't have electricity, it had gas light, and so forth and so on. Well, the first thing that happened was that the building inspector said, I'm sorry, we know you are going to be bending some of the rules about safety, but you can't bend all of them, and there's some things you cannot bring back to 1900, because especially, there was energy things. It was about how the gas lights were supplied with gas within the household, and the way the chimneys worked and so forth. So it was really illuminating to see this. And they had this servant who, I mean, wash day was just something horrendous. I mean, it was absolutely horrendous. You know, there was a separate wash house in the back, and she started out by heating water over the stove, I mean, over a setup actually in the wash house. I don't remember exactly how it went. But people don't, you say, oh, you know, we use electricity for this nowadays. We're so wasteful. We were wasteful of people's lives back then.
No kidding. No, exactly. If you devalue human labor, then yeah, do that kind of stuff. It's you know, it takes a whole person all day long, and it's not easy work. It's backbreaking drudge work. I just find this. I find it amazing that we're being wasteful of energy, and well, what's the alternative? What do you want us to do? How do you want us to fetch our water? We could carry it, or we can use an electric pump. It's incredible.
Well, with that note, I think I'm going to bring us to a close, because I know that...
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
It's okay. It's okay. It's been a delight to talk to both of you. I continue to have fond memories of our jaunts across the... country of France, and seeing all the wonderful sites of French nuclear installations. And I'm glad that we've remained in contact and close after it's been getting on 5 years now.
Almost 5 years, that's right. Boy, I'd love to.
We should have a 5-year reunion.
We should have a 5-year reunion, and we should do another tour somewhere else.
Okay. That would be good. You know, there's some good nuclear facilities here in the U.S. Maybe we could. And we'll cross the border into Canada. We'll have to come up with a plan.
Yeah, some Manhattan Project themed plan or something.
Well, that's not my favorite part of nuclear history, maybe
not,
by the way.
Yeah, I just find it either.
Well, because we have Chalk River here, and Chalk River was one of the original.
Yeah, but you guys did better things at Chalk River since then.
No, that's true. That's true.
You've been making some wonderful isotopes for us, cheaply.
Yeah, well, don't get too used to it because it's ending in 2018.
Well, Susie Hobbs took an amazing tour of Europe, not really centered on France, for nuclear installations. We could look back at what she did and try and redo parts of it.
Yeah, I think she went to Belgium and the Netherlands too, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. Man, oh man. UK would be interesting.
Yeah, but she's got an advantage that none of us have.
The whole idea of nuclear art, I think that was really the draw.
Oh, I know.
She does some really interesting stuff.
And it is fantastic. Thank you both for spending this time on a Sunday evening. I hope that you remembered that yesterday was, the 36th anniversary of the Three Mile Island event, and the one that really put a damper on us reviving nuclear after a lack of orders throughout the mid-70s. But anyway, take care.
Pleasure to talk to both of you.
All right. Bye-bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.